Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and yes, this is the last episode of the weekly show for 2021, which went pretty quick. What a mixed bag it's been. Let's hope for more normal times in 2022. We can always hope. This week's show is brought to you by Grey Noise. Grey Noise monitors internet background noise for things like mass attacks. They then provide that data to you so that you can better prioritize incident investigations. And yeah, Grey Noise founder Andrew Morris joins me this week to talk about two things. First, he has done a $30 million deal with the US Department of Defense. So if you work in a defense agency or department and you want to use Grey Noise, that is now very easy for you to do. So we talk about that. And we also talk about Andrew's adventures investigating the people who are spamming the anti-work manifesto from Reddit to receipt printers all over the place. And I'm not kidding, I got to see the Discord exchange between Andrew and one of the people who was actually doing this, and it was very, very funny. He basically just popped into the Discord. He's like, yo, is this you? And it's, it's good. So that interview is coming up later, and I do have an announcement after the news, so do stick around for that as well. But let's get into the news now with our co-host, Mr. Adam Boileau of CyberCX. And Adam, we're going to start things off with this report from the Washington Post here, which seems to confirm reporting that I had seen earlier. I got to be honest, that the so-called Pegasus spyware was used to hack US diplomats working in East Africa.
Yeah, this reporting says that, you know, a number of local and US employees of the American embassy in Uganda had been identified by Apple as being targeted by one of the Pegasus exploits that they've been looking into. And a few weeks ago, we were talking, you know, when those sanctions dropped against NSO and Kangaroo about, you know, kind of that something must have changed, because, I mean, some of the relationship between NSO and the US hadn't been that fractured before. And, you know, we were kind of wondering exactly what had changed. And it turns out, yeah, this report did, I guess, you know, explain a few things, and you could certainly see why the Americans would be a little bit salty about having Pegasus tools, you know, Pegasus show up on some of their devices. Where in the past we've seen NSO say that their tooling can't be used on American phone numbers, I think in this case these were people using local SIMs, local phone numbers in Uganda.
Which makes a lot of sense if they're long-term staff, right? Like if you're going to be living somewhere for a couple of years, you're not going to be on roaming the whole time.
No, exactly. And yeah, so between Apple going around and notifying people, the lawsuit from Apple against the NSO, and then, you know, this now being... Because as you say, we had had a bunch of reporting about, you know, some targeting data for, you know, allegedly NSO customers being shared around. And that had like a really big number, like 40,000, something like that.
Yeah, but I did see specifically reporting about State Department officials' phones being targeted in East Africa. Like that was a thing that I had seen before. I think what's changed is that Apple's talking about it and the US government's talking about it. So it's sort of like about as confirmed as we're going to see it.
Yeah, exactly. Because that previous reporting was a little bit unclear. I mean, the overall reporting was a little bit unclear about, you know, exactly whether it was like people who'd been attempted to be targeted or whether they were people who'd been successfully targeted. Or, you know, it was a bit unclear there. So yes, you're right. This is a, you know, a much clearer set of circumstances, and now we've got some context as to, you know, why NSO got a little bit spanked a few weeks back.
Yeah. I mean, we still don't quite know why Israel has restricted export to the degree that it has, because that's a separate issue to the sanctions. But at least now we can have a pretty clear explanation as to why the United States government is so annoyed, right? And it might explain sanctions against some of the other, yeah, as you said, Kangaroo, there are a couple others in there as well, including our mate Thomas Lim at CoSync. So, yeah, I mean, when the United States says it's sanctioning or adding these companies to the entities list because they're acting in ways that are contrary to US national security interests, this is the sort of thing they are talking about. And I'm sure software like this has popped up in other places as well that we haven't read about in the newspapers. Now, look, staying on the topic of, you know, the surveillance industry, we've got a report here from Bloomberg. So please excuse us. But we do have a report here from Bloomberg about a company called Mitto, based in Switzerland, that was apparently involved in some shady business, Adam.
Yeah, so Mitter provides a bunch of like text messaging services for big companies. So when, you know, you want to deliver multi-factor SMS or password reset links or whatever else, you know, typically individual companies don't interact directly with the mobile network themselves. They use a third party that, you know, handles all of the gubbins of dealing with, you know, all of the network operators and things. So that was the kind of business that Mitter was in. And apparently they were quite a large player, you know, providing SMS delivery for, you know, Google and Twitter and WhatsApp and Microsoft LinkedIn at one point, a bunch of other people, although I'm not sure what whether those are current or prior customers. So yeah, big firm that has, you know, all of the interconnect arrangements and the SS7 phone network equivalent of a bunch of IP addresses. So they're kind of on the network and they can communicate. And apparently one of their founders was running a side business or a side arrangement inside the company, providing access to surveillance data using the same sets of, you know, of interconnects and their access to the global SS7 network. And yeah, apparently most of the company was not actually aware of this, but yeah, the guy had a bunch of relationships with companies that provided, you know, kind of surveillance services, or in some cases, one of his colleagues had said something about him saying he had contacts in, you know, with the Middle East and, you know, government's intelligence services. We don't exactly know who. And yes, this, you know, kind of looks pretty shady. Lots of, you know, location tracking lookups, including of some people, you know, US State Department, which, you know, the question of whether there's any relationship between, you know, the story we were just talking about, you know, and Pegasus and NSO, you know, whether you would imagine this being maybe some of the sources of the targeting data that we were talking about. We don't really know that. But, you know, in terms of the way that you would do that, figuring out where people are, sending them text messages, maybe using the roaming system to reroute messages, you know, there's a lot of alignment between the sorts of things you might like to do if you were, you know, running a phone hacking business. So, yeah, interesting. And the company is saying that they knew nothing about it and, you know, will take some action. You know, what that looks like, given it's one of the founders that's been involved with this, we don't know yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting story, right? Like, I'm not super clear on the on all of the details here. And you're right, it's intriguing as to whether that big targeting data set that we saw a while back might have actually come via this company. Do you know what I mean? Like, because that was, a lot of people thought it could have been some sort of telco services company that offered them a particular type of lookup via their network. So, I mean, who knows? Could be a connection there.
Yes, it certainly could be. Like, it's the sort of thing that you would do if you were, you know, trying to figure out where people are, figure out how to deliver them messaging and exploits and things. If you needed more privileged access to the network to send, like, crafted messages, this would be a good way to do it. The story from Bloomberg does say it's based on interviews with, you know, a bunch of people that either worked there or worked at, there's a couple of quotes from people that worked at a company that bought these surveillance services from Mitter, and said that the guy had it, like, installed their software inside Mitter's environment to kind of facilitate that access. So, you know, it seems like a pretty well researched story, and there's some corroboration where, you know, people outside have looked at, like, patterns of lookups from, you know, across the phone networks to, you know, look at individual targets where, you know, there's been, you know, 50 or 60 distinct requests to track the location of a target from all around the world, but where all of the global titles, which is kind of the equivalent of IP addresses in SS7, were all owned by Mitter. So there's, you know, kind of external corroboration of some of this as well. So it's a really, you know, it seemed like a pretty solid set of reporting.
Written by Ryan Gallagher and Crofton Black. That's the byline on this piece, and they are not associated with any of Bloomberg's, you know, problematic coverage that we've spent so much time talking about in previous years.
No grains of rice in the story.
Now, look, talk about a plot twist. You know, earlier this year, we spoke about the breach at Ubiquiti, right? And Ubiquiti described it as a breach at a third-party cloud vendor, you know, nothing to worry about. That turned out to be code for our entire AWS environment was compromised, right? So that was pretty interesting. And then a whistleblower who worked there popped up in some reporting from Brian Krebs on Krebs on Security, who really dished on the breach. Now, it turns out the DOJ is now alleging that that whistleblower was actually the attacker. Where this gets even more interesting is it looks like, as best I can tell, everything that this guy actually told Krebs seems to actually check out, except he omitted a couple of things. Firstly, being that he was apparently the attacker, at least according to the DOJ. And second of all, he like criticized the fact that they only had like 24 hours of logging, but also omitted the fact that that's because he disabled the logging and made it only log for 24 hours. But, you know, bit of a weird story, this one. Nicholas Sharp, a senior developer at Ubiquity, has been charged.
Yeah, it is a really funny plot twist. And like, I really did like your take that essentially the things that he said were true. Like, Ubiquity did seem to have kind of tried to downplay the incident. And obviously, and this guy was involved in the incident response. That's yeah. One of the things I thought was particularly funny was that, yeah, he was there, you know, with the team that was responding and digging into it. And, you know, we're not clear whether he turned the logs off in advance or just, you know, kind of reduced the amount of logging in advance, or whether, like, you know, you could imagine him logging in during the incident going, there, that's an inconvenient log. Maybe we'll just decrease the retention slider a little bit there and make it go away. But yeah, so he looted like 150 sets of repositories from inside their AWS environment over the space of a couple of weeks. And apparently his downfall is he'd watched too much YouTube and been sold on one of the many VPN providers that advertise on all the social media platforms. And so he was using Surfshark to do his crimes. But occasionally, you know, if his network connection dropped out of home, and then, you know, the browser retried faster than his VPN came back up again. And sure enough, some IP addresses of his real connection leaked into the logs at the other end, and got busted from that. So I think, you know, one of the real takeaways here is if you're going to do crimes with a VPN, make sure you know how they work and you have some manner of failsafe to control to stop you leaking traffic outside of your VPN.
Put something that only connects to VPN between your box and the internet is usually the way to do that, right? So if you can't go through the VPN, I mean, but, you know, don't use a VPN, maybe use Tor, but that is a whole other thing we're going to get to later.
That story coming up, yes.
Yeah, I had a funny chat too with Brian Krebs about this because, you know, I said to him, you obviously verified that this guy worked for Ubiquity. And he's like, yeah, of course I did. You know, it wasn't difficult. And he had so much insight into what was going on. But anyway, fun stuff. Yeah. Now, look, we've already seen it mentioned by other US government officials that Cyber Command had performed some manner of offensive actions against ransomware crews. We've now seen confirmation of that from Paul Nakasone, the man himself, who is the Cyber Command commander and the National Security Agency director. So he was giving some testimony or something, and he's like, yes, we have released the hounds. So that was interesting. But, you know, again, no more detail on what that actually was. Are they just talking about cloning a couple of, Tor hidden services with some stolen key material? Like, we don't really know. And this drags us back into that whole conversation about cyber campaigns and their value as a deterrent, which is considered to be pretty low when it comes to actions between states. And we just don't really know what that deterrence value looks like when applied against criminals at this stage. So, yeah, interesting development, but it doesn't tell us all that much.
No, I mean, it's good to see that the hounds are having a time, but yes, the how the deterrence works, like whether it's more useful, it being kind of vague and spooky and they're jumping at shadows the whole time, or whether it makes more sense to say, you know, we are the ones that, you know, nicked someone's Bitcoin wallet and gave it to the FBI, and we have imposed a specific cost on criminals, like X million dollars worth of stolen Bitcoin, rather than, you know, kind of generic, spooky, woohoo, you know, sorts of things. So,
yeah.
I guess we're going to see. We don't know. This is a new domain for them.
Yeah, the Canadians also came out and said that they were imposing costs on ransomware crews as well. So they have joined the list of... there's two lists, really. There's the list of countries that say they're going to do this sort of stuff. Australia is on that list, for example, a few European countries. And then we've got, the list of countries that are now confirming that they've taken those actions. And this week, that's, we already knew about the Americans, but yeah, the Canadians are doing it as well. And, you know, in what could be a related story, Adam, apparently the FBI seized $2.3 million in Bitcoin from an affiliate of Revel.
Yes, they managed to pick up the guy's Bitcoin wallet and have handed it over to the FBI. Apparently, this belongs to one Alexander Sikorin, who went by the name Lelatu on some of the crime forums. So, yeah, they've helped themselves. The usual sort of thing. We don't know how the FBI got hold of it, whether it was the spooks what done it, and if so, which spooks, we don't know. But, certainly, you know, if you're hiding your criminal proceeds in your wallet under your bed, then... yeah, maybe watch out for that, all you criminals.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to see them going after the money, actually. And I've linked to the forfeiture court paperwork and stuff in this week's show notes, so you can have a read of that if you're interested in it. Now, look, a ransomware attack that we must talk about this week is the one that, you know, it's a data breach and a ransomware attack against Planned Parenthood in the United States. So 400,000 patient records, basically, which includes details on, like, medicines prescribed and, you know, procedures performed, which, should that data find its way onto the internet, is nothing short of disastrous. And I think events like this kind of disprove this idea that we can just focus on critical infrastructure. Do you know what I mean? Like, Planned Parenthood doesn't fall into the critical infrastructure bucket, but this is probably one of the more disturbing attacks we've ever seen, you know, and probably one of the highest impact ones as well, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, this one is really, really hard reading, and especially given the kind of political complexities around, you know, reproductive rights and those sorts of things in the US at the moment. Like, it's the sort of data you can really see being used in a really, you know, hostile, negative, you know, harmful way. And I'm, you know, it brought to mind for me the, you know, Finnish psychotherapy firm
that
had data dumped. Like, if we saw the same, you know, phoning up individuals and, like, individually trying to ransom them. Like, if that happened, that's just really horrible to even consider. And so, yeah, this is really, yeah, nasty.
I mean, I can't think of really much that I've seen in 20 years of covering this that's more despicable than this. This is horrible.
Yeah, it really is just disgusting. And, yeah, it makes you sick reading it. And although we haven't seen currently reports that the data has been published somewhere yet or is, you know, is floating around, it's just... I really hope it doesn't come to that, you know.
Me too.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. We've also seen Canadian police arrest an Ottawa resident over some ransomware attacks. I'm guessing affiliate activity, is that right?
Yeah, it looks like they didn't say exactly which ransomware crew they were affiliating with. I guess not that it really matters these days. Yes, but, you know, picked up and, you know, good work to the Ontario Provincial Police.
Now, Adam Janofsky over at The Record published a bunch of ransomware statistics on their website. Now, the reason I'm mentioning them is because of the lack of insight that we can draw from these statistics, right?
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting because I'll give you an example, right? So... ransomware sort of peaked as a public issue around, I would say, you know, May, June this year. And those look like low months, according to these statistics. And then you've got other charts here that just look like statistical noise. There's not really much rhyme or reason to them. And I think this, the fact that these charts are so, with full respect to the team at The Record who compiled them, the fact that we can pull such little insight from them is sort of proof that you can't approach trying to get your hands around this problem by using charts and statistics, right? A chart can't tell you the difference between an attack against Planned Parenthood or a regional bank. It just can't describe the real-world impact of the problem. But I just thought it was interesting to look at these charts and go, wow, they tell us really not that much.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, obviously collecting data and storing it and publishing it so that, you know, we can look at it, that's a genuinely useful thing. But you're right that these graphs and, you know, the very, very limited amount of insight is in itself genuinely interesting. If anything, it kind of underscores the fact that ransomware affiliates kind of don't care who they're hitting. Like, I mean, the chart of, say, like, attacks against healthcare providers is essentially random. And same for, I mean, the attack on school districts has some kind of pattern to it, but, like, I don't know that you can draw anything from them. And that in itself, yeah, I guess it's interesting because we are used to dealing with risk still, you know, in the kind of classic, you know, probabilistic risk management sort of way where we are dealing with, you know, natural disasters and we're dealing with things that are not human-led and all of our way of thinking about risk is kind of predicated on that. And just, you know, it's a different thing when it's a, you know, a human on the other end. And, yeah, the amount of insight you get from knowing whether, you know, Conti did more than Egregor, you know, so what kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. No, and as I say, like, full respect to them for doing the work to see if there were some meaningful insights that could be drawn from this, but I just don't think there are. And I think we need to reframe this a little, you know, instead of thinking about the criticality of an affected sector. The other problem too, and I was talking about this with Tom Uran, who writes our newsletter, you know, and he thinks, you know, you've got to classify certain things as critical, and okay, fair enough. But he does also worry that if you classify, if you say this is a no-go area, it's almost a green light to target everything that's not on the list. And I think we maybe, you know, we might see that play out next year. But let's talk about nickel. Let's talk about nickel, also known as APT-15. Such a crazy world when Microsoft dispatches the lawyers against a Chinese APT crew, Adam. Microsoft dropped a big report on this group that they're calling Nickel. And I guess, you know, flicking through it, I guess what I found interesting about it was how boring the hacks were that Nickel does. You know, mostly they're targeting flaws that have been patched where the, you know, the organization hasn't applied the patch. So just, you know, boring workaday stuff, run an exploit, drop Mimikatz, onwards and upwards. I think they were using a couple of ODAI and like border, you know, network border devices. Typical, very typical of 2021 and the last 20 years really. But yeah, they actually, Microsoft managed to obtain a court order to seize a bunch of websites from this APT crew. So I guess that's the novel angle on this one.
Yeah, it is funny seeing the same techniques that they've used against crime gangs just, you know, being reused against state actors. And yeah, jacking the DNS names of, you know, C2 or other, you know, watering holes or whatever else that they were using. I mean, I'm sure it is a bit of a pain. I mean, on the other hand, the fact that, like you point out, that the attacks and the techniques seem so kind of workaday, you know, the same applies to their infrastructure. They're obviously used to, you know, building new infrastructure, building new delivery, you know, mechanisms and so on. And, you know, they've got a job to do that is going to get on and do it. Even if Microsoft goes and, you know, takes their domains, they're just going to have to stand up some new ones. So, yeah, it's depressing in a way that, you know, hacking, which used to be kind of fun and exciting, is now, you know, so boring.
Well, yeah, it's just, I was like, I was reading this going, this is like workflow-based training. Yes. Clearly these operators have been trained in a certain workflow and it's a boring workflow.
Yes. Yeah, I feel sorry for them. Like, you know, hacking used to be fun and they're stuck doing the boring stuff.
It's like, I just kept thinking of like, this is like the call center script of hacking. You know, yes, like with the flow charts, like if this, yes, then that, exactly, you know, and I'm like, oh God, you know.
Yeah. The story is also funny because, I mean, Microsoft calls this group Nickel, and I saw Katie Nichols on Twitter saying, no, and this Nickel without an S, like don't come at me, because with the articles to talk about, you know, Nickel's targets and Nickel's techniques. And yeah, Katie Nichols was like, not me, don't blame me.
We know it was her though, come on.
Probably was.
Doing a bit of a sideline. Yeah. Now we mentioned this earlier, we alluded to this story earlier, but there's some very, very funny stuff going on with Tor. Someone mysterious is operating like 15% of Tor, right? Like 900 malicious servers that are apparently linked in some way that's not really clear in this story, but the researchers who linked them, I mean, Tor seems to agree with their findings. But yeah, since 2017, some mysterious group has been operating an awful lot of the Tor network, Adam, and that would, of course, allow them to do things like locate the true, you know, find the true IPs of things like Onion services, probably decloak some users as well. And, you know, you just read this and you're like, who says SIGINT agencies don't do nice things for open source, right? Because here they are operating a large chunk of the Tor project. I mean, it's possible it's the Americans, it's possible it's someone else. I mean, it's a little bit, in some ways, it's almost a little bit obvious to be the Americans, but you know, at this point, if we're seeing public reporting on, like, you know, this many hundreds of servers being operated by SIGINT agencies, I wonder about the rest of them as well, right? You know?
Because, I mean, the reporting talks about, I think, a peak of 900 malicious servers being run by this operator in Tor, which, you know, is something like 10%. 15% of the network over time. And yeah, I read this and that was my first thought. It was like, okay, if this is one intelligence agency, I wonder if the entire Tor network is just made up of intelligence agencies from different countries, like paying the bill for the entire lot. And there's like, you know, three, you know, crypto enthusiasts, cyberpunk enthusiasts, you know, running a couple of middle nodes, and the entire rest of the Tor network is just intelligence services trying to
decode. I saw some comedy sketch once, like in some comedy show where like, some FBI guy went to arrest, you know, undercover FBI went to arrest someone. It turned out he was from the DEA and the other guy was from some other, you know, I think everyone's seen that one, right? And it turned out everybody was an undercover someone. It sort of feels a bit like that. That could be the case with Tor these days.
Yeah, I think so, maybe.
I mean, they do have big supporters, right? So like they know who the organizations running a lot of these servers are. That's true, but you would have to think anytime you're going to let this thing scale, you're going to have a real SIGINT problem.
Exactly. I think in this case, one of the things they were looking at was like Tor boxes that didn't have good contact information or had weird contact information, and they were, you know, trying to do some analysis and figure out the patterns of, you know, whether there was coordination. And in this particular case, the relays they were running and entry nodes they were running, you know, were a bunch of cloud providers from all across the world, but there were some similarities, of which, as you say, the article wasn't super clear what.
Yeah, because it would need to be more than them than just linking them because they had bad contact information, yeah, right? Yeah,
so it must be a bit more to it than that. But yeah.
One of the reasons that I think it's not the Yanks. I figure, you know, it's a little bit too lazy. I would think the Americans would actually set up some, you know, front companies that look like they're really committed to internet rights or something.
Yeah, exactly. I do think so, yeah. But I do love this, you know, whenever we see reporting kind of like this about Tor, because, I mean, you read the initial pitch for Tor and it's like, this is, you know, protects, you know, your anonymity so long as, you know, some percentage of the network isn't malicious. And it's like, well, someone's just going to get out their credit card and cross that threshold. So, yeah, I mean, that guarantee only holds if people don't really want it a lot. And, yeah. Turns out they do.
Yep, that is true. Now, an interesting story here, a non-technical one. This is from Tonya Riley at CyberScoop. But the US Department of Justice is cracking down on money mules. And I thought one thing that was interesting, one thing the DOJ has done, is it's notified something like 4,500 people, written them letters saying, you know, you might actually be committing fraud and not know it. And I think that sort of awareness campaign among people who are at that point kind of already on the hook for charges, just letting them know, probably a good move. So it looks like they're trying to approach this the right way.
Yes. I mean, we've seen, you know, plenty of recommendations about the ways we can tackle cybercrime. One of them, obviously, is following the money and imposing costs in that kind of part of the supply chain. This seems really sensible. I mean, the amount of money that they said that they had recovered so far was, you know, pretty small, like 3.7 million. So kind of small in the scale of things. But yes, like just going and shaking down a few of the people who, you know, maybe haven't really faced up to the fact that they are part of a money muling system. Like, I mean, if you, you know, answer ads or whatever else and end up just kind of moving money around without really thinking, this may make that a bit more complicated.
And it's also this is meaningfully going to raise awareness, right? When you're literally writing people letters, you know, there's a bit of a network effect there where people start talking about it and whatnot. Yes. So, you know, definitely worth the shot. So whoever's running that initiative over at DOJ, good for you. one of the FinCEN people has been to court for you know, doing criminal hacking in Russia and got a 1-year suspended prison sentence. so it looks like, on the surface of it, it looks really weak. So this guy, Maxim Zukov Sergeyevich, yeah, he was on the hook. Apparently he was working for the front company that FinCEN used to run, which was Combi Security. It's not clear if he was working for them at the time that he was arrested. It's not clear if he was, if he knew what he was actually doing. I mean, it's possible he didn't, which would explain the light sentence. But it's also possible that, Russia's courts just don't take this stuff very seriously.
Yeah, apparently he was a Ruby developer, worked on Metasploit
stuff,
Metasploit stuff for them, which, you know, I could imagine that you could just write tooling and not really see how it's being used. But yeah, we don't really know. And kind of regardless of how he ends up with, you know, what looks like a pretty light sentence, you know, it doesn't really send much of a message that Russia has taken seriously or much of a deterrent, I would imagine, to anybody else who's, you know, writing Ruby for criminals or, you know, whatever else that they are doing. But yeah, it's pretty underwhelming.
Oh, we spoke a couple of times about these cyber incident reporting mandates that were due to become law in the United States. They were being squeezed into the National Defense Authorization Act. According to Tim Starks at CyberScoop, he wrote a story saying it was looking like it might die, and it is dead for now, unfortunately, Adam.
Yeah, there's been some, you know, obviously there were some arguments and discussions about exactly what the proposed law should look like, and there was a bit of back and forth between the Democrats and the Republicans about, you know, kind of time frames for reporting and kind of who had to report, and that kind of process didn't meet the timeline requirements to get into the bill, and as a result it's been kind of shelved for now. Maybe they'll take another swing at it later, but yeah, it doesn't look like it's going to go through as part of the NDAA.
Now, look, a topic that we, you know, we love to talk about and have a bit of fun with. The crypto world is having a bad week, Adam, and a worse week than I think I've ever seen. For starters, Bitmart. Bitmart's an exchange. They lost $150 million of Ethereum out of their hot wallet. That's a lot. I mean, why have you got 150 mil in a hot wallet? That was my question.
Yeah, that is a very good question. And it seems like probably like some staff member got breached and they lost the private keys and they were subsequently transferred out. But yes, they had 150 in their hot wallet. Apparently, they're fine with that. They're just going to cover the losses out of presumably their cold wallet because all of this money is imaginary anyway. So, you know, 150 mil, eh, whatevs next kind of thing.
I mean, I don't know if these guys have moved to daily settlements or whatever, these crypto exchanges. But what's funny is, like, as more and more of this stuff goes on, the more and more they're going to actually start doing things the same way the banks do them. And the more they're going to get regulated. It's like, you know, cryptocurrency has just proven why regulations are the way they are. Over a 10-year period. It's just pretty nuts. And we've got another one, Badger DAO. Which is one of those decentralized things. What are they called? Decentralized autonomous organization or whatever. They got themselves owned for $119 million of made up money. And now they're begging on the internet for the person to give it back and promising to give them rewards and things like that. So that's, so what are we up to now? 150 plus 120. Okay, so 269 million and counting.
Yeah, I think in this case they were like someone nicked some API keys for talking to Cloudflare, and then put loaded malicious scripts into their CDN, and off they went, which pretty smooth, I thought. Actually, that seems like worth $120 million.
Yeah, and another one, there was a smart contract bug affecting Monox Finance, and that was $31 million. So hey, look at that, even $300 million.
Even 300 million, yeah, that's some pretty real money, you know. I mean, 30 million stolen doesn't seem that big compared to 150 and whatever else, but that's still very, very real money for, in the end, what are pretty stupid bugs, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I want to talk about a blockchain-based phishing attack that I just thought, now you just mentioned you thought that thing was smooth. This is smooth. So someone is airdropping tokens to people via the blockchain. And you have to accept them because it's a blockchain thing. Like, they've been given to you, But then there's like a URL in this transaction where you can click it and, like, you know, sell these tokens that you've been given. And of course, this website asks for access to a certain type of wallet software. And as soon as it gets that access, you know, ostensibly to help you sell your $30,000 of free money that someone just decided to transmit to you over the internet, it will just steal all your money. So that's, you know, I just think this is a really cool modern example of there's some innovation here in crime. I like it. I'm all for it.
But yes, it was exactly what I felt as well. Like, it's a beautiful thing. This is very well done and 100% predictable. What could possibly happen if we glue money to computers in this way and let people just build their own random financial systems? Like, of course it's going to end like this. And like continuing your process of adding up the numbers, the actual numbers for the year are like, what was it, like $10 billion?
Yeah, I think you were saying in Slack earlier, like if you added up all of the money stolen by all bank robbers in all of time, it wouldn't add up to what was taken in cryptocurrency this year. You made the good point, which is bank robbery has influenced culture, you know, to such a degree, you know, movies about it and things like that. And yeah, and here we are with a lot more money going missing elsewhere. But, you know, you compare it to BEC, and BEC is still king, but no one talks about it because it's dumb.
Yes. Even credit card fraud is still in the order of what, like $20 billion a year globally. So $10 billion a year in cryptocurrency bros having their stuff stolen. You know, I guess that's, you know, still only half as bad as credit cards, but
yeah.
Can you imagine, right, if someone walked into a bank and robbed it? Like, you're going to get what, like some, maybe a mil or two, yet here we are, you know, 150 million, 130 million. Yeah, that's, and yet there's going to be no cool movies, right? No heist movies are going to be about, you know, changing a JavaScript in someone's Cloudflare.
Well, this is why I thought, like, it was odd that some movie studio licensed Brian Krebs reporting on the Target breach years ago, because I'm like, is it going to be a movie where Brian's sitting at his computer you know, maybe a glass of scotch in his hand, tapping a keyboard, like in a forum. Like, how does that, it doesn't, it's not it. Anyway.
Googling air conditioning vendors or whatever.
So I'm just shocked that the big Hollywood production of, you know, Brian Krebs reporting on the Target breach never got greenlit. Stunned.
Stunned. He's going to play Krebs in the movie, though. Is it like a Bruce Willis?
I think they were talking Mark Wahlberg, actually.
So, actually, yeah, I could see that. I can see it too.
Fully. Now, Catalan's got one here. So we've got a couple of stories here that I did want to cover because they're actually, again, sticking with the theme of like smooth moves, right? We've seen some Mage Cart attacks that are actually kind of smart in terms of being a little bit stealthy. So that's the first one of these I want to talk about. This is a story from Catalan at The Record. But walk us through what these particular Mage Cart skimmers were doing that was clever.
So, like, normally when you Mage Cart someone, right, you gain access to their website and load some JavaScript into their, like, you know, static content directory, or you do it through a CDN, or if they're pulling out, you know, JavaScript dependencies from a third party, you know, like jQuery or something, from a place that you've compromised, you can kind of modify those JavaScript dependencies. In this case, the attackers were, their trick was they would sign up for Google Tag Manager, which is a, you know, part of the kind of Google Analytics ecosystem. And then there's a feature in Google Tag Manager where you can kind of add custom tracking of your own, which will be delivered by Google's, you know, network to those sites. So they made a sort of a malicious configuration of Google Tag Manager. Then when they hacked your site, they would just kind of enroll you into that particular Google Tag Manager feature that they've added. And then if you're auditing, you know, if you're doing a security review, if you're doing incident response, like, you're just going to gloss over the Google Analytics, because every website has it. You look at it and go, that looks like normal. It's talking to Google directly. There's no shenanigans going on, like, next kind of thing. And then, yeah, have that do the Mage Cart style, you know, form capturing and so on. That's really smart. I never thought of that. Like, that's just smooth.
So I don't know. You probably had the same reaction when I sent you this story. Firstly, where you start reading it and you're like, ah, oh, boring. And then you're like, well, hang on.
Yeah, that's actually kind of, smooth. Good job, whoever did that.
Yeah, and look, the second one of these we want to talk about this week, this one comes from the Hacker News, but someone's doing like payment data stealing malware, but they've hidden it in the Nginx process. And I'm like, that's also pretty cool.
Yeah, this is you know, pretty classic Unix technique of using LD preload, the like mechanism where you can override library functions at startup time to inject an in-process, you know, kind of card scraper, and then, you know, exfil out something else. And of course, it's running inside, legitimately inside Nginx. It looks exactly like every other Nginx, you know, thread or process you've got running. Yeah, that's smooth trick. Definitely some, you know, classic Unix technique, which always, you know, warms the cockles of my heart.
There you go. A couple of examples of smarter and stealthier card scraping there. We don't normally talk about bugs all that much, but we got a Catalan report here. Zoho, man. Another O-Day in Zoho Manage Engine and Manage Engine Desktop Central, which is their endpoint management solution. The reason I wanted to talk about this one is because, first of all, it's being exploited in the wild. But second of all, it's about to be exploited in the wild an awful lot more, right?
A lot.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, and some of the reporting, so Palo Alto have been tracking, I think Palo Alto, CrowdStrike, a few other people have been tracking groups using this particular bug before it's got reported and patched. And yeah, those campaigns going back, you know, 3 or 4 months now, targeting, you know, in some case, defense industry in the US, you know, finance, healthcare, education. So, you know, kind of has been properly used in the wild, not just a little bit used in the wild. Anyway, there's a patch out now. But yeah, if you've got Manage Engine internet facing, probably you need to not only patch, but probably it's time to go do incident response and start hunting, because there's been enough, you know, scanning activity for this that probably you already owned.
Yeah, so you know, they used to have the terrorism alert threat chart, you know, with the different colors. You remember that through the Bush era?
Yeah.
I think we need to hook up like a meter to Mandiant's switchboard, you know, and basically we can judge, you know, what sort of state we're in based on the volume of calls through the Mandiant switchboard at any given moment in time.
So right? If only we had like a tame SS7 operator that could give us like call stats into Mandiant, and then we could sell that as an intelligence service.
That's actually not an insane idea. Because I'd love to just know their call volumes.
That'd I know, great, right? Yeah. How many text messages an hour get delivered to people who are, you know, physically located at Mandiant's offices? Yeah.
Mm. There you go. Mm, someone idea. Get cracking on that. Let us know. Give us the feed. Turn it into a Slack bot. We'll subscribe. And yeah, look, another one here from Catalina. Look, you know, not earth-shattering, not an earth-shattering report here, but apparently some Chinese, Russian, and Indian APT crews are using like a template injection style attack into RTF documents. So I'm guessing what these templates contain macros, don't they?
Yes, I think so. That's the way that it works. Yes.
You get the RTF file, you open it, and then it tries to pull a template from the internet, which contains a macro. Of course, user needs to click enable content or whatever, but you know, it's just a novel way of getting some of this macro malware past your, you know, email scanning and whatever. So this is a trick that's very popular right now.
Yeah, and people have been doing this with other document formats, Doc and XLS and PowerPoint and so on for a while, but I had no idea that you could actually also do this with RTF.
I didn't know RTF supported this sort of thing either.
Yeah. So that's some good work. But yeah, using this so that the initial document is benign and goes through all of the mail scanning and content inspection and stuff that doesn't necessarily have the ability to, you know, spot, you know, this particular trick, that's pretty smart. So yeah, I'm sure some people have got themselves good and owned with this.
Yeah. Now, I got two stories here that pair together actually quite nicely. The first is from the Daily Swig, written by Adam Bannister, which is talking about like basically SQLI in the management of like Tonga's TLD. And of course, Tonga is .to, and there's a lot of link shorteners that use it. So it's almost like critical internet infrastructure. Yes. And there was just this like terrible straight up SQLI that could have let you just mess with the whole CCTLD. So that's fixed. They fixed it in under 24 hours, but it just goes to show you that, you know, you can have these huge systemic vulnerabilities in unexpected places.
Yes. Yeah. I had never even thought of that. Like, but totally makes sense that, you know, a bug in a place like that, you know, that, you know, Tonga is not a huge country. I don't know how well resourced their, you know, their NIC is. Having SQL injection, that probably not super surprising. But yeah, they were able to just SQL inject out the creds to then be able to go update the, you know, the domain registrations for .2, and that's like you could do a lot. I mean, there's some cryptocurrency exchanges or whatever that use .2 as well, so you could have got yourself pretty rich out of that had you done crimes with it. So yeah,
nicely done, Sam Curry, who was and Palisade, who found that one.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
And we got a great write up here. This is from someone called Sebastian Suller. Someone just sent this to me. It's dated December 1. It's just a really interesting write up of how like some not so up-to-date SPF records can really get out of hand.
Yeah, this is funny. So this guy was looking at SPF records and had the idea to go look for places with overly permissive SPF records that permit you to, like, SPF records specify what IP addresses are allowed to relay email from your domain. So if you're inside an SPF record, by and large, you're going to get through a lot of spam filters because the domain has designated you as a legitimate sender. Anyway, so he went and looked at the list of IP addresses that were permitted for a bunch of domains, looking for ones that included cloud service providers. So if you can, you know, stand up an Amazon box or an Azure box and get an IP address that was previously permitted, then maybe you'd be able to do that. Anyway, he found a place. It was the government of Queensland in Australia that had allowed the entire Australian AWS IP address pool to be a legitimate sender for them. And he started pulling the thread as to why, and it goes back to an external like third party service provider who had configured that for them some years ago. And so then he pulls that thread to find the other customers of that service provider. And they're very conveniently, like, they listed all of their customers on their like references page or whatever. So yeah, he went and scraped all of those and identified, you know, a couple of hundred domains in Australia that anybody who can sign up to AWS can send mail from, which I guess probably wasn't the outcome he expected when he started that research. And so it's always a joy reading a blog post that kind of goes through that voyage of discovery. So anyway, it's been fixed by this managed service provider now. But yeah, it's kind of that was a funny jaunt, I thought.
Yeah, and a little bit embarrassing for people who, I mean, but this is the thing, isn't it? An overly permissive SPF record leads to, oh my God, right? And I can imagine there would be a few places that just wouldn't think too much about their SPF records and what can happen if someone can send mail as you, you know?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And especially if you're just glancing at your SPF record, like this big list of AWS domains or AWS IP addresses was just included from another location. So you can have an SPF that references another SPF. So you have to kind of walk the whole chain to really see it. So if you're just glancing in your DNS zone file, it's very, like, if it was, you know, what was it, like 100,000 IP addresses in there individually, you would absolutely go, hey, that seems a little bit excessive. But when it's just one include, it's very easy just to kind of gloss over and get on with your day. So you can see how it happened. But, yeah, a little bit embarrassing perhaps.
Yeah. Now, everything's in pairs this week. I've got a GitHub. I saw this being passed around on Twitter. It's a GitHub project, which is basically just a list of, like, cloud security mistakes in you know, things like AWS and whatnot. And it just makes for pretty grim reading, actually. And it's, I think this really hammers home to me that the, you know, the cloud is the OS sort of thing. When you start looking at the bugs in Azure, you start looking at the bugs in AWS. This is sort of where operating system research is going, but it's, you know, the cloud service is the OS sort of thing. Did you get that vibe from it as well?
Yeah, absolutely agree. I mean, you know, kind of mentally modeling something like AWS as a, you know, it's a big operating system with inter-process communication and a bunch of resources that are managed by, you know, security rules that are managed by, you know, an operating system that you can't see up into. It's very much like the old days of a proprietary operating system, you know, that you have to go and do the resource to research to understand how it works. And I was quite pleased with this because, I mean, keeping mental track of all the bad things that have happened to everybody, you know, is a thing that as a security person you kind of need to do. And for an operating system, like, I can vaguely remember, like, these sorts of Linux locals or that, you know, file system permissions kind of work like this on different platforms. But with the cloud, it's changing so quickly and there's so much complexity, it's very hard to keep track. But sorry, I can listen. Like, this was a really good read, refreshed my memory on a few bits. There are a few things that I hadn't seen. You know, I don't remember that being cross-site scripting in the EC2 web console, but that seems like not ideal. So yeah, I hope that, you know, the person or people doing this, you know, keep maintaining it because it seems like a valuable resource.
You do see things like this spring up and then they sort of, people get bored of maintaining it.
Like, it's not very glamorous doing this kind of, you know, kind of tracking, data collection and normalization and, you know, kind of coming up with, you know, searching down all of the references and resources and stuff. So yeah, it's not glam, but genuinely useful. So thank you.
Well, yeah, and it's just a good read, isn't it, to scroll through and just give you a sense of the vibe. And then right on cue, Sentinel Labs from, you know, Sentinel One, dropped a bunch of research. The name on the blog post is Kasif Dekal, and I don't know if it's just Kasif's work or if it's a more of a team-based thing, but just thought I'd mention the name. And yeah, right on cue, multiple vulnerabilities in AWS and other major cloud services, and that's the USB over Ethernet stuff. And this one, I rubbed my temples like I was you, Adam, reading this one.
I had no idea that this was, well, I guess I had an idea that the general technology was a thing, but I'd never really thought through what it meant. So this was some research into the mechanism by which cloud providers that are providing, like, full-featured desktops do USB device redirection so that you can connect a USB device from your terminal at the edge of the network and deliver it as USB to a machine hosted in the cloud. And I used, I think a bunch of the cloud vendors and other providers use this a library that did this. For a company called Altima, their USB over Ethernet solution. And this guy, this research, looked at some, like, memory handling, kind of logic, kind of memory handling bugs in this Altima driver. But the net result is kind of, you know, memory corruption in kernel space on the Windows machine at the far end via remote USB, which... Yeah, that's a bad thing.
You scroll the, like, executive summary of this thing up the top, and that's a lot of CVE numbers.
Yes, and in particular, this is a thing that Amazon were using in their Workspaces product. There's a bunch of other vendors as well, but obviously Amazon's the kind of the big one here rather than, you know, FlexiHub or Donglify that I'd never heard of. But yes, this, yeah, I rubbed my temples.
Yes. Yeah, I was channeling you, just rubbing my temples. Look, it's a good write-up too from Sentinel. So I've linked through to that one in the show notes. You can check it out there. But Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. And that's actually it for another year of Risky Business. It's been my 15th year and your 13th year doing this program. So, you know, it's crazy, isn't it? We've been through a lot together on the show, off the show, known each other for a long time, man. And, you know, what a crazy old world that we're still doing this so many years later.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, like, how much the show has changed over the years and how much kind of, you know, my positions on things have changed over the years. I mean, I was obviously a lot more Unix cypherpunk nerd you know, back in the early days, and I think we've both sort of
converged.
We've kind of, our opinions have kind of crossed over the years, and as we've varied on our positions about things we've talked about. But it is just, it's really interesting thinking about how much has changed. When Stuxnet, Stuxnet broke during the time we've been running the show, and that really changed a bunch of things, and Snowden, and getting to see a bunch more openness from the spook community. There's just, there's a lot that has changed. Used to be about bugs.
I mean, since when I started, because of course you weren't actually, and a lot of listeners wouldn't know this, but you weren't actually the original co-host of this show. I did a couple of years with someone else, with Minia Katadia, and then some fill-ins here and there. But I think, when I first launched this show, I don't think you could even buy an iPhone in Australia. So you couldn't buy a smartphone. So a lot has changed.
That's fair. That's pretty wild.
Anyway, I was wearing an onion on my belt because that was the style at the time.
Pushing our packets uphill both ways, uphill to orbit, 400 milliseconds both ways.
But look, sincerely, Adam, thanks for being part of this for so long, and thanks for finding the time every week. I do really, really enjoy and look forward to our weekly conversations. It's always a lot of fun, and I can't wait to do it again next year. Thank you, and I'll catch you next year.
Yeah, it is always a heap of fun, and I'm also looking forward to see, what I might love a good disaster, and we're in the right place to talk about them. So we'll come back next year, and once again, everything will be ruined, and it'll be a great time. So yeah, I'll see you then.
That was Adam Boileau there. And hey, here's the announcement that I prefaced at the intro of the show. For the last 6 months or so, I have been working on setting up like a video sponsorship product, I guess you'd call it. And we're now doing product demos on YouTube. And the thinking is that audio is great, and we've been doing audio for, as you just heard, 15 years. But sometimes you've actually got to see things in action. And that's what these demo videos are about. So they're like half an hour product demos, screen share sort of thing. So this week I've actually published two that we've recorded. One is with Material Security, which makes a product that secures and redacts email at rest and gives you some interesting insights by looking at your email, your corpus of email. And the other demo is with Remediant, who are a longtime sponsor, and they make a network deployed PAM product that you can actually roll out in a couple of hours, right? So a little bit different to the old PAM in that sense. Do hit up this week's show notes for the YouTube links. Go check out those demos and let me know what you think. Those are, of course, sponsored videos. And I think it's a fresh YouTube page. I didn't want to just publish these on the existing Risky Business channel because people didn't subscribe for sponsored content. So if you want to find it, it's called Risky Biz Product Demos. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Andrew Morris of Greynoise. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Greynoise has a bunch of sensors out there on the internets, so they can tell you when an IP that's hitting you is also hitting everyone else. So if you work in a SOC, you would know that's very useful. Greynoise has just signed a $30 million deal with the US Department of Defense. As Andrew will explain in just a moment, this means if you work in a defense agency, it's now very easy for you to get Greynoise. In this interview, I also talked to Andrew about his adventures chasing down one of the people spamming internet-attached receipt printers with the anti-work manifesto from Reddit, and that is so funny. So do stick around for that. Here's Andrew Morris.
So, obviously, it goes without saying the Department of Defense is gigantic. And basically, the really cool part about this contract is that now, whereas before, if any kind of subgroup within the Department of Defense, of which there are a gazillion, if any of those subgroups wanted to buy Greynoise before or use Greynoise, any of Greynoise's enterprise products, it would have been a whole big ordeal to kind of go through procurement and go through any kind of contract process and stuff like that. It would be really painful for them and it would be really painful for us. The really cool part now is that now any organizations inside of the Department of Defense, once they come to the conclusion that Greynoise is something that would be valuable to them, it's something that they want, they see that it's going to provide value, then they can buy Greynoise, just lob it onto that contract. And basically we don't have to worry about procurement. The contract is basically built. It's you just pick what you need off of an ordering guide and you're off to the races.
Yeah, right. Okay. So it's like basically authorized for internal use, budget allocated, boom, boom, boom. Just if there's
bingo.
People in DOD listening right now who would like to use Greynoise, getting it is easy. So that's really, because the headline deal is like $30 million, but it's more like that.
Right.
That's like a cap for the,
that's
for
the
how
cap,
much
right,
you can
exactly.
sell into
so,
there. Yeah.
So some of that's been allocated already as part of like kind of our initial announcement of the deal and allocating that within some groups inside the DOD. But yeah, I mean, we've basically got, you know, we've got 5 years to basically, as the contract's written right now, we've got 5 years to basically stack $30 million onto that of orders from any groups within the Department of Defense. So that's something that I'm really excited about.
Now, one use case you gave me is when people in DOD are being ordered by their superiors to chase down, to chase wild geese. This is actually quite useful at pushing back on that, right?
So I can't tell you how many times I've anecdotally had conversations with people within the military, within the Department of Defense, where the story has been something like, hey, you know, my boss's boss is making us basically kind of go through a really painful investigation of some stuff that raised an alert. We're practitioners. We're grunts that have been doing this for a long time. We're looking at this traffic right now, and our intuition is immediately telling us this is stuff that we don't need to care about. This is stuff that's hitting everybody. But without any kind of outside corroborating evidence on that, you can't just say like, hey, just trust me, we're going to skip this. You need to have some kind of reputable sources that you can point to and say like, look, this thing agrees with me. Look, this is not something that is unique or special to us. We need to just move on. And that can actually give you the credibility to be able to skip a bunch of really useless investigation time to be able to spend more time on kind of the more useful, interesting stuff. And honestly, the stuff that requires, you know, actual analyst effort and not just, you know, chasing ghosts and not, you know, going down rabbit holes.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine, though, that, you know, with military chain of command style management, you can't just say to them, oh, it's probably nothing, right? Like they're going to...
Right. Exactly. And so even though, you know, it doesn't matter how sure of it you are as an analyst, like you need to make sure that you're following through with all of the, whatever the procedures are to investigate that kind of stuff. And honestly, I've never served in the military, so I can't say this from my own experience, but cybersecurity is a young field. So anyone who is above a certain age, by and large, it's less likely that that person was, depending on the rank, et cetera, was actually boots on the ground doing cybersecurity work when it was common at the time. This is a long-winded way of saying that because the field is young, it is the higher ranking you are, the less likely it is that at any point you were boots on the ground doing cyber. If you're
the
doing,
higher ranked you are, the less likely it is that actually know what you're talking about.
making
friends through this interview within the DOD where your new contract is.
The higher ranking you are, the less likely it is that there was a role that existed within the Department of Defense or within the military that was a highly technical cybersecurity role by the time you've made it, you know, in that way. And so you need to have some way of basically getting, you know, your superiors and getting, you know, the people in your chain of command to basically kind of corroborate your analyst instincts that you have that are probably correct. And that, you know, the people who haven't spent as much time doing the work that you have, they're not going to have that same sixth sense, that same analyst sixth sense that you do, that you've developed. So this gray noise is really helpful in that way for basically pointing at something and saying, look, don't take my word for it. Gray noise is saying the exact same thing that I am.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. I mean, that's a hell of an achievement for a small, young security startup to sell into defense, because normally that's quite an ordeal. I'm sure it was still an ordeal. Don't get me wrong, but I'm almost a little bit surprised that you were able to get this one over the line. So congratulations on that. The other thing we wanted to talk about, this is something we spoke about on the news last week, is someone going out there and basically sending print instructions to receipt printers with the anti-work manifesto from Reddit. And just causing all of these receipt printers in hospitality and retail environments to spit out like instructions for people to unionize, which is, you know, just a bit of fun, old school, internet shenanigans, basically.
It almost reminds me of war dialing, right? I mean, it's like war printing, right? It's functionally the same thing.
But I mean, people have done that before, right? Like some of the early hacktivism was like sending black, you know, whole black sheets to be printed or faxed or whatever, right? So, you know, this is kind of old school stuff that we've seen before. I did already see, before we spoke today, that Gray Noise was flagging the IPs that were sending this out, which I imagine would be useful to some organizations, but I'm guessing more you were looking into this because it's funny.
So honest to God, when you have the vantage point that we have, there is a subcategory of things that are like extremely tactically useful day in, day out. There's a subcategory of things that are like totally useless to anybody. And then there's a subcategory of things that are just really interesting. They're really interesting and they are like really interesting kind of observations that you can't necessarily tactically do anything with, but that are just wild and sometimes unexplainable. This is one of those things that's like, it always brings kind of a smile to my face to see things like this, people still doing like really creative and interesting stuff like this. And especially anything where there's like any kind of gaping security hole that I've known about for kind of some time, and that a lot of people have known about for some time. And then someone starts exploiting that thing at massive scale, and then everyone cares, and then a little bit of action happens. In this particular case, exactly like what you were describing, somebody suddenly started blasting out raw print instructions with about 5 different documents that all contained pro workers' rights, basically messaging and unionizing messaging that was basically giving kind of step-by-step instructions on how to put together a union and basically kind of in giving a little bit more, I would say, almost weight behind like, hey, you know, you're being exploited as a worker, you know, your conditions are bad, et cetera. And so it's really interesting. We started seeing it happen a couple of days ago. And then Constantine, one of our researchers, tweeted about it. And then almost the same day, somebody pointed out on Reddit, there was a person that was working in a restaurant that posted on a subreddit that was like, all right, who's doing this? Our receipt printer keeps spitting these things out and they're just shooting out and we're all laughing about it and it's not stopping and it's just going on. So it's really interesting. We've started seeing that and it's kind of interesting for a couple of different reasons. One of the reasons is that it's clearly like a thing that is top of mind for a lot of people right now. Two is that it's not new. Like this is to your point, like we've seen this happen. We saw this happen with, unfortunately, there was some like Nazi anti-Semitic propaganda that was going around about maybe a year, 2 years ago with this, where someone was basically putting all this, all this terrible stuff.
But this one's resonating. And as you say, it's a matter of timing, right? It's just a wacky incident. That's such a sign of the times right now with everything that's happening, you know, in retail and hospitality in particular, not just in the United States, but everywhere where a lot of people left those jobs because of the pandemic and they don't want to go back. Thank you very much. So,
And you have to think that there's at least some people out there that basically stuff like this can actually set over the edge to basically say like, honestly, like forget this job or forget this thing, which is interesting.
I think it's interesting because it feels like maybe in a year from now, you know, there'll be these really powerful hospitality workers unions thanks to these campaigns, right?
So I think the other really funny thing about this is that when you take a step back, it feels like kind of almost like a caricature of the fear campaign, the fear tactics that a lot of security companies have always said about IoT devices. And like, oh my God, you know, you don't want to put a smart thing in your fridge because all of a sudden your fridge is going to, you know, explode or whatever. And a lot of people in security are like, that's, you know, less likely to actually happen. And then we've got one of those that's actually happening, which is if you plug a point of sale system into the internet the wrong way, it's just going to start spitting out, you know, basically messaging that somebody wrote somewhere and you're not going to be able to control that. It's going to be doing that in thousands of restaurants, thousands of hotels, thousands of different places around the internet. That's one of the reasons it's so interesting. It sounds like a cartoon. It sounds made up. Happening right now.
One of the reasons I brought this up is because today, like just before we got recording, and you even shared your screen with me so I could see you talking to this guy in Discord, and it's hilarious. You actually tracked out, you actually looked at one of the IPs that was doing this, realized that had a website attached to it, went to the website, there's a Discord link. You jump into the Discord and you start saying to the guy, hey, you know, this you, bro, sort of thing. So take it from there.
The funniest thing, we're sitting around in a hangout literally 30 minutes ago, me and a couple of the folks on the research team. And basically Remy notices, hey, this website, one of the IP addresses that is blasting this document out is hosting this website. And we go to the website. And it's basically the same IP address that's hosting this website is like blasting this printing document out. There's a Discord link on there. I'm just like, hey guys, wouldn't it be funny if I just hopped on this Discord and started like chatting with whoever was doing it? So I hop in and I'm chatting with the guy who's running the thing. And he's like, hey, this must be a, you know, blah. Oh, this isn't me. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, he said, my favorite thing is where he's like, oh yeah, that's the same IP, but it must be a different server on the same IP. And it's like.
I resolve DNS for his website and I show him the linking gray noise. And he goes, oh, well, I rented the server just 1 or 2 days ago. And I'm like, it's happening literally right now. He's like, oh, there must be some mistake. I've cycled the server. It's no longer going to happen anymore. And it's just like the most ridiculous thing that it's so funny to just like hop in and just like chat with the person who's doing it. Clearly wasn't particularly well.
But you know right now, well, as we're recording this, you know, this guy's probably throwing hard drives into a burn bag right now, right? You know that.
I mean, and it's possible that something's off. It's possible that we're wrong. We don't necessarily know that the exact person that I was talking to is doing this. But I can tell you right now that the person that's operating that website, that's blasting these documents out to everybody, is somebody that it's that I was just chatting with. I mean, 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. It was pretty funny because, you did actually share your screen and walk me through this. And I saw the messages in the Discord, and it is like probably a teenager who is just shitting bricks right now.
Yeah, I have a message from him from about 20 minutes ago that says, I've deleted the server with IP 168.110.80 from my account, blah, 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 moved the site. It seems like my server was used in a separate attack. I'm like, okay.
Yeah, okay, right, man. And it's like some Bitcoin, Bitcoin payment, you know, like virtual server thing.
It's one of those cloud providers that you give a little bit of Bitcoin to and they spin up a server for you or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's got all the trappings of some pretty sketchy stuff. And it's probably kind of an edgy 17-year-old who's reasonably good with computers. But it's,
yeah, but that's why it's funny is because
it's
like
a very fun hour.
Because as far as that kid is concerned, you're like representative of the party pooper man, right? Who's come in to go, yo, is that, and all you did is say, yo, is this you? You're just messing with him. But it's funny because, as I say, he's probably like looking out his window for black helicopters right now. It's so funny.
Yeah, and I'll see. I'll be interested to see if it continues beyond this, because if it's still going on after this, then that would be interesting. And if it stops suddenly, that would be way more interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not just one IP doing this, right?
No, it's 25.
25,
and,
yeah.
Which is one of the reasons it was interesting, because it's not hard to build a system that blasts a bunch of stuff out from one place. It's not hard to do it from a few places, but to properly round robin something from 25 places isn't hard, but it requires work and it costs, a certain amount of hundreds or thousands of dollars, which is how you know that a person is a certain amount of resourced and has a certain amount of like know-how in a certain space. So it was good enough.
I wonder if this person that you were just talking to in Discord, I mean, maybe it's them. So yeah, as you say, if it all stops now, that's interesting.
That would be extra interesting. So it's kind of just a funny thing. And me and like the research team were just laughing about how funny it was, because they thought I was joking when I said that I was going to hop into the Discord. And then I was like, no, I'm actually doing it. And I shared my screen with them as I did it. And you're all laughing about it. It reminded me of back in the day when you would reverse engineer like a really bad bot, and you would figure out like an IRC bot, and you'd figure out the channel that it was like connecting to. And then you would just join that channel and you'd see all the like the other like the hackers that were in that channel. And you're like, yo, what's up? I'm in your server now. And you'd start chatting with the people that are running these botnets. It reminded me of that.
Yeah, yeah, totally. All right, Andrew Morris, congratulations again on your gigantic mega deal with the U.S. Department of Defense. That's great stuff. Thanks for sharing that anecdote about chasing the anti-work print people to shady discords on Bitcoin rented servers. That was funny. Thanks for bringing me in on that. Good times. And that's our last sponsor interview for the year. Great stuff. We'll be chatting to you again next year. Of course, you've signed up for 2022. So I will catch you in the new year, my friend. Thanks again.
Always a pleasure, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
That was Andrew Morris of Grey Noise there with a chat about popping into weird discords to freak people out. You can find Grey Noise at greynoise.io. Big thanks to them for being this week's Risky Business sponsor. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in a couple of days with a Soapbox edition featuring Thinkst Canary's Haroon Mia. And I'm going to do something at the end of this show that I don't do anymore, which is to actually play some music, which is something I used to do in the early years of Risky Biz. I just wanted to play this because it's just a mad keyboard solo from a TV theme from the 1970s British cop show The Sweeney. So I'm just going to drop in a couple of minutes of this mad keyboard solo because I just wanted to share it with you all because it's great. I will be back, as I say, in a couple of days with that Soapbox edition, and then that's it from us for the year. It's been a real pleasure hosting this show throughout 2021, and catch you all soon.